everyone, and welcome to Social Sport. I'm your host, Emma Zimmerman, and this show is a member of the Sidious Mag podcast network. On Social Sport, I feature conversations with endurance athletes of all types committed to fostering social change. These athletes are climate change activists, they're mental health advocates, promoters of more inclusive outdoor spaces, and much more. But what ties all of these athletes together is that they're committed to exploring the connection between sport and activism in their lives. Thank you to Paper Trails Greeting Co. for sponsoring the Social Sport podcast. Paper Trails Greeting Co. is the most comprehensive and adorable line of running greeting cards out there. It's owned and operated by an athlete just like you. Plus, there are cards for birthdays, for running distances, motivation, and so much more. Valentine's Day and Galentine's Day, too, are both coming up, and regardless of your opinion on those holidays, I can assure you there is nothing better than receiving a card from a friend or family member. So go to papertrailsgreetingco.com and use code SOCIALSPORT for 15% off your order. My guest today is Zoe Rome. There is a large chance you are already familiar with Zoe's work, and if you're not, you should be. Zoe is the associate editor of Trail Runner magazine, and she writes, produces, and hosts the DNF podcast. Zoe's environmental journalism background shines through in her work. She doesn't just report about trail running and outdoor adventure, but she often reports with an environmental and environmental justice lens. Among Zoe's accolades, she won a Colorado Broadcasters Award, and her reporting has been featured on NPR's All Things Considered and Morning Edition. Zoe is someone whose work I really look up to, so this was a really exciting conversation for me, and I know you'll enjoy too. Hey Zoe, welcome to Social Sport. I'm stoked for this conversation.
Yeah, I'm so excited, Emma. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So I introduced you in the intro, but I'd love to hear from my guests. Who are you? Where are you right now? And what are you passionate about?
Yeah. So I'm Zoe Rome. I'm the associate editor at Trail Runner magazine and the executive producer and host of the DNF podcast. I'm currently in Carbondale, Colorado, which is where I live, which is like, it's on the western slope of Colorado, like 30 miles outside of Aspen, kind of in the mountains. And I don't know, I'm passionate about running and people and planet Earth.
Amazing. I have lots of FOMO looking at your Instagram pictures as I'm here in Brooklyn, New York, and like running in city parks. You have the most beautiful trail running pictures out there.
Oh man, my backyard, I love it out here. It's so, man, the Rocky Mountains are just one of the most amazing places on Earth.
I totally agree. Yeah. The more and more that I talk to people who are in like Colorado and Montana on this podcast, the more I'm like, why am I in New York?
That being said, like there's like three restaurants in my town. And like at this part during the pandemic, I would just like kill for some Chinese food.
Valid. Totally valid. I do have every sort of food I could ever want in my neighborhood.
DoorDash. Like, man, there's some days where I'm just like, man, I would love to get a delivery pizza.
Yeah, totally. I feel ya. So you mentioned you're the associate editor of Trail Runner magazine, and we were just talking about how the first ever environmental issue of Trail Runner magazine will be on stands in March, and I'm so excited about it. Could you tell everyone what that is?
Yeah, so we are doing our first ever like fully environmental issue of Trail Runner magazine, which means that the focus of the majority of articles will be on the environment and environmental justice. This is hugely important to me because I think so often we're used to seeing like climate through a really narrow lens in trail running and in endurance sports particularly, right? Like an article that focuses on like the impact of wildfire or flooding or avalanches on trails. And my mission with this magazine was to examine climate change through every lens possible, right? So every department of the magazine is written through that perspective. So the nutrition article is about how to eat in a way that is more environmentally minded. The gear reviews are all about how to consume less gear, like telling people instead of buying buy this. It's buy less things, fix more things. Here's how to be a more savvy consumer. The features are all about environment. We have one that I'm writing on individual and collective action. Claire Gallagher is writing one on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We have one about threats to public lands and extraction. And so it's just looking at every single piece of like what it means to be a trail runner through an environmental lens, because my mission is for readers to just not be able to escape that perspective. I think because like for me, like I see the world in a way that like it's so apparent that climate affects every single choice I make. But I think so often I produce a product that makes examining things through an environmental perspective really escapable. And I just want people to understand how connected these issues are and understand that like climate impacts everything we do as trail runners, not just one thing very narrowly.
This is so important, Zoe. And if I wasn't excited before, I'm like super eager to read this issue now. And I know that environmentalism and the intersection of the environment and so many other issues has been central to your work for a long time. So I want to take a little bit of a step back and start kind of from the beginning. I know you grew up in rural Arkansas. A lot of what you write about is rural and environmental issues. So I can imagine your childhood played a role in it. Is that a correct assumption to make?
Yeah. So I grew up just outside of Fayetteville, Arkansas. My dad is a second generation apple farmer, grew up on an apple orchard. And I always just grew up like outside. And I think something that's really important that makes, I guess, like my upbringing in the South a little bit different than how I live in Colorado now is that my relationship and a lot of people's relationship in the South to the outdoors is like a lot more permeable than it is maybe in Colorado. Whereas like maybe I didn't have access to the same level of like public lands. We do a lot of things outside. And so your relationship to the land is maybe a bit less formal, but I felt like I was always playing outside, you know, like going to church barbecues outside, football games outside, like working on the farm outside, working at the farmer's market outside. And you spend so much time outside, maybe not necessarily like in national parks or state parks or engaging, you know, like I feel like in Colorado, there's this like big separation between like outdoors and indoors. And like, I'm an outdoorsy person and I'm being outdoorsy when I go and do an 18-hour like alpine climb. But in Arkansas, you're just kind of outside all the time and you just have a very different relationship to land and space. And you're very close to those things without maybe having to like formalize the relationship quite so much. And I think growing up, like, you know, from a family that was had ties to agriculture, I was always very aware of how climate and the environment impacts like every level of life. My dad's specialty in terms of his research is sustainable fruit production. So I just kind of always grew up around this ethos of like food and land and climate being kind of the linchpin of everything we do.
So many interesting things, you know, that were brought up in that. And I think it's so true that we kind of like commercialize this idea of environmentalism and outdoor recreation and sustainability when in so many rural communities and especially farming communities, folks have been doing this, you know, living outdoors, practicing sustainability for generations and generations. So yeah, just what a great example of that.
Yeah, I think people, you know, I never really thought of myself as outdoorsy growing up. I was just always outside, you know, like you have a big yard, you're out on the farm, you're at like a tailgate, you're, you know, you're not necessarily engaging in being outdoorsy, you're just outside a lot.
Yeah, totally. So then you went on to the University of Arkansas, you studied English, and I know that you focused on environmental literature and eco-poetics, which is just incredible. I want to go have your undergrad experience. That sounds amazing. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and what you learned from that experience that you brought with you today?
Yeah, I originally went in wanting to study religious literature, and I was really interested in, you know, like how people engage with spirituality through literature. And that kind of brought me into like studying William Blake and William Wordsworth. And I like totally fell in love with Wordsworth and Walt Whitman and like saw how these poets engaged with landscapes in their writing. And I totally fell in love with that. Like I felt like, you know, as I kind of like started to question my own relationship to like formal religion, that like the environment kind of slipped in its place. And I was like, wow, people, you know, enter transcendental literature, where I was like, oh my God, there's like people have just been replacing religion with like the outdoors or with the environment for a very long time, and like having this like really fulfilling spiritual relationship with outdoor spaces and environments and landscapes. And that really spoke to me, like at a time when this vacuum kind of opened up and I wasn't feeling a close connection to like my religious upbringing. I felt an even closer connection to my like natural and environmental upbringing. And so from there, I kind of like, you know, transcendentalism was like the gateway drug to like Walt Whitman and Edward Abbey and Mary Austin, and then, you know, like Terry Tempest Williams and Rebecca Solnit and these amazing environmental writers who really informed my thinking in terms of like how we can use literature and writing to connect people to landscapes they might not otherwise feel a very close connection to. And I was working as a backpacking guide during the summers at the time. So like I would spend my summers like literally living in a tent outside all the time, just like loving it, reading all the time. And then I would go to school and I just felt very like confined by the academic atmosphere. And like, I was spending so much time in the library reading and I just felt like this isn't like what it's about. You know, I'm like spending so much time reading about being outside and just like dreaming about my summers where I get to live outside. And I wanted to find an academic study that spoke to that yearning I had, and ecopoetics just totally married my love of both like poetry and literature and engaging deeply with outdoor spaces in a way that like creates empathy between the reader and the landscape.
When you mentioned that you came at this from kind of a religious background and environmentalism slipped into the place of religion, that's so interesting to me because when I read your work and listen to your work, religion and spirituality don't necessarily come to mind, but now hearing you speak, I'm thinking there is something inherently transcendental, if you will, spiritual about the outdoors. Could you talk a little bit about that? Why are the outdoors spiritual, if that's the word you would use to describe?
Yeah, I think they very much are for me. And I think the type of religion I was raised in had a very strong environmental stewardship ethic baked into it. Like being raised once again by like a farmer, like the way that my father and like my grandfather always engaged with the outdoor space was like, you know, like reading biblical passages that had to do with like agricultural metaphors and outdoor metaphors and how we were entrusted with like this greatest gift, creation, to engage with and take care of. And so I was always raised like with this very spiritual, like land, once again, like relationship to the land and an understanding that it is our job to be stewards of the environment, and that that's an inherently, that's a responsibility of us as humans, right? Like with this gift we're given. And so I still, you know, I still feel that that kind of spiritual aspect does inform what I'm doing in my writing now. But I think, you know, the whole, like the like very formal religion aspect of it became less authentic to me. But I've always thought that like a lot of my thinking and writing around like the environment and climate justice is so informed by my upbringing in the church and like my desire to care authentically and fully for all humans and all creatures and all parts of, you know, creation, however you want to define it.
I love that so much because I think it's so easy to kind of like throw away the parts of our childhood that we don't vibe with, but yeah. it's so much harder to be like, okay, well, I can take something from this that actually fits with what I believe and my values. And that's just really incredible to hear.
Yeah, I think, you know, once again, like there's definitely very solid criticisms of organized religion. But I think that, you know, so much of how I understand my love for people and my love for the environment comes from those early teachings and understanding myself from day one to be a steward of this planet.
Totally. So before you worked for Trail Runner magazine, you had lots of different environmental journalism experiences. You were in grad school at Colorado, and you've done such incredible and interesting reporting. I mean, you've reported for NPR, you've reported on sled dog racing, you traveled to Norway to report on Arctic exploration. Do any of these experiences stick out to you?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the reason I went on to study environmental journalism is because as I was kind of easing out of that world of like academic environmental literature, I was like, okay, like I want to like put what I've learned from like literary criticism into practice as a journalist. Like I love what people like, you know, Edward Abbey have done to engage their readers with a specific landscape, but I want to take that a step further and maybe make it more accessible to people because, you know, there are very real critiques of Desert Solitaire, but it does make you really connect with the landscape imagined and pictured in that book. And so I wanted to do that same thing as a journalist. And I was like, oh, well, environmental journalism, like I'll be able to take what I learned from literature and apply it like to a thing that like more people will engage with and like actually read on a daily basis. And that was kind of my goal there. But yeah, I just, you know, another thing is like, I always saw like in environmental journalism is like a very like adventurous job as well. And I was always trying to parlay it into like the biggest adventures I could. So like one of my first jobs in graduate school is I worked as the science communications intern for the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research at CU, which was awesome because you got to like snowshoe up to high alpine, you know, research stations where they're like, I got to see the second oldest carbon record in the world, which is really cool, just outside of Boulder, Colorado. And like being from the South, like snowshoeing just feels like such an incredible adventure. And I was invited to go to this conference in Norway my second year and do research on the best way that people research, like how ice moves in the Arctic is that they'll basically just freeze themselves into it and then chill and like drift around for like a year at a time. And so one of the really cool things that has happened in the past couple of years is like this one of the largest ever Arctic research exploration, kind of in that same vein, the Mosaic expedition happened, where basically a coalition of scientists from all over the world froze themselves into the ice and just like watched where the boat drifted. And people have been doing that since like the 1800s, which is so cool. So I really wanted to take like a historical perspective and study like, you know, why do people just freeze themselves into ice for research? Like, what do we learn from that? Like, what is the point? And then
freeze themselves into ice. I want to unpack this a little bit.
Yeah.
What does that actually look like in process? Mm-hmm.
So you are on a boat and you put the boat in ice and you just let it freeze around you and then you just drift. And that's like how you track the movement of ice, is you just like are on the boat for like, like the Mosaic expedition was, I believe, 2 years, and you just track where it goes throughout those 2 years. And like on the more modern expeditions, people will like come and go, like helicopters bring different scientists on and off or journalists on and off, or like there was like one of the people I interviewed, it was like his whole job to like chase polar bears away from the research instruments. So people like kind of come and go. You don't have to be totally like on the ship the whole time, but like one of the historical expeditions that I researched, like, yeah, these guys like in the, I think like the 1860s just fully had to like freeze themselves on this boat and then just drift around for like an entire winter just to see where it went. And that was like some of the earliest like Arctic research that we have available. And that's like how people first uncovered that ice doesn't just like sit there. It doesn't just freeze. Like it flows like water does, like it moves. And that was very important for our understanding of how dynamic Arctic sea ice is.
This is intriguing. When we get off this call, I have to do some more research.
I know. I applied to be one of the journalists on the boat and didn't get it because I was technically not graduated yet, but I was like, yeah, I don't know what could be better than just sitting on a frozen boat for years.
So cool. Well, you know, I'm curious about that though, because you are a runner. So I do wonder if you would fare well frozen on a boat for 2 years, because I personally would not. And that leads me to, I'm wondering how you got from these very diverse, interesting journalism experiences to Trail Runner magazine.
Yeah, you know, I think in like, actually, so in, you know, one of the other things you had touched on is for a while I lived in Alaska as a sled dog reporter, and I couldn't run like at all while I was reporting on that, just because like I was living out of my backpack. Like the only way I had to get around was like I would hitchhike or like take bush planes around, or like I had a rented van for a while. But like, you know, running around the Alaskan interior in the dead of winter is like not really a thing. So there's definitely been times where I've sidelined my running career to forefront the journalistic side of things. And I think that had I been selected to be frozen on the boat, that would have been one of those times. Although I could definitely see myself like jogging around the deck of a boat frozen in ice. But so after I graduated grad school, I moved to Aspen to report for Aspen Public Radio on issues around the environment, particularly the environment around the outdoor recreation and ski industry in Aspen, Colorado. That was kind of my specialty. It was like looking at the economics and environmental impacts of outdoor recreation. And from there, I became very interested in bringing my public radio reporting background to Trail Runner magazine, because I was really interested in starting my own podcast and trying to bring just like a higher level of journalism to outdoor reporting generally.
Totally. And you did start your own podcast. If anyone listening isn't familiar, Zoe hosts the DNF podcast, which is, in my opinion, I think in many people's opinions, one of the best outdoor slash running podcasts out there. And there's something different about it. It kind of is the more like NPR style storytelling rather than the long form interview. There's an interview component, but it's really telling a larger story, which is super compelling and pretty unique, I think, in the outdoor and running space. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and the motivation behind it?
Yeah, I basically just wanted to make a podcast that I wanted to listen to and one that kind of represented the way that my brain works, which was getting a little bit away from the, like you said, long form interview and doing a more highly produced storytelling style podcast, because sometimes people aren't always the best at telling their own stories, which is excellent job security for people like you and I. Like, that is one of the reasons that journalism exists. And we get to come in and kind of help support other people to tell their stories in a way that feels maybe even more honest and more authentic by kind of like adding scaffolding around their narrative.
Amazing. And yeah, and what a great job you've done with that. People definitely have to check DNF out if they haven't already, which I hope they have. I want to go a little bit deeper into some of the issues that you report on now for Trail Runner Mag. And a lot of that is around climate change and kind of the intersection between sports, specifically running, and climate change. And one recent article you wrote, Climate Heroes and Hypocrites, was really compelling to me. If you don't mind, I'm going to read a quick quote from it that stuck out. It's less important that I bike to work than it is that I push the officials that represent me to adequately regulate the fossil fuel industry. What I'm able to do individually is just a drop in the bucket. What we need to do is change the bucket. So this really gets at the need for systemic change to confront climate change. But how do we get athletes, trail runners in this case, to funnel their energy towards pushing for systemic change?
Yeah, I think this is such a great question. I think for so long, you know, particularly, you know, the last 4 years, there's been such a leadership vacuum around these issues that so many people have taken it upon themselves to overemphasize individual action to the detriment of collective action. I think this also speaks a little bit to maybe the myth of like rugged individualism that we as Americans a lot of times tend to depend upon, and that there's a very strong strain of in the endurance sports and trail running community as well, right? That like we believe so much in our own power and our own responsibility as individuals that we forget that we have even more power and even more responsibility as a collective. And so I think a lot of times what it comes down to is we try to fix things through the lens of trail running, or we always try to talk about things through the lens of trail running, right? Like how to be, you know, how to recycle goo wrappers, or like buy sustainable shoes, or like carbon offsets for races. And while those are all meaningful actions, they do not go far enough to address the issue. In order to really address the issue, we need to break out of the lens of trail running or outdoor recreation or endurance sports generally. And we need to come together as a political force to encounter these very big problems, because as long as we were like, you know, dabbling in like 4 million really small solutions like recycling and like, you know, minimizing how we engage with animal agriculture, or like where we buy our shoes, or like, you know, how much, like if we take 5-minute showers or whatever, like while those are all good things to do, they do not go far enough to address this issue, because it is so deep-seated and it crosses borders and it crosses generations. And it's a really big problem that can really only be meaningfully addressed by concerted collective action, typically through policy, which is like not always the sexiest thing to talk about, right? Like, I know that people don't come to Trail Runner Magazine for like hot tips on how to call their senator, but that's what I'm here for anyway.
And the thing is, would trail running you know, exist if there wasn't collective action to fight climate change. There, it probably wouldn't in the future, you know? So
it's, yeah, exactly.
It really is related.
And I think that that's like the problem is that, you know, we always talk about like how climate is going to impact trail running, right? Like there was a huge wildfire right outside of my town this year. It was literally raining ash on us for like 2 weeks. Like trails I run burnt down. There were trails outside of Boulder that burnt down. California had the largest wildfire season ever. So like it is very, in a very real way, it is impacting what we do. However, we cannot fix this problem by trying to like stay in our lane and only fight back through the lens of trail running, right? And I think that so often, you know, trail running related solutions either tend to be like, you know, things like trail building or, you know, like having a more sustainable race. And while those are great things, that it just, that's not going to be enough to like, you know, right the ship. And so we just need to adjust like kind of our perspective on like what we're able to do as a collective. Like we need to start understanding that trail building is not the most profound environmental action we can take, but like voting is, writing your senators is, financial divestment from the fossil fuel industry is a great action that you can take, and trying to just reorient what we see our role as being. Instead of an individual, we need to be a collective. I think one of my favorite quotes is from the writer Bill McKibben: the biggest thing that you can do as an individual for climate change is stop seeing yourself as an individual. And I think that that is really the foundation of it.
Totally. Yeah. And one thing about the individualism that I'm curious about is I also think that industry and kind of capitalism as it surrounds the outdoor industry is pretty focused on that individualism. I mean, it's easy to sell, buy this sustainable fabric, eat this plant-based chicken, what have you. But I think it's harder to, through industry, get people to protest, call your representatives, et cetera, fight for big systemic change. So how do we push the industry to move beyond these small personal choices? Is it possible?
I think so, but it is going to take a bit of a radical reimagining of what the outdoor industry can and should be. Capitalism is what got us into this mess. And I think it is magical thinking to imagine that capitalism can get us out of this mess. And I think we need to build an entirely new industry that is a lot more focused on equity, justice, sustainability in like a really deep and authentic way. Like you said, there's so many solutions that focus on these really small, narrow-minded things and tend to engage with people as capitalists or consumers more than citizens, which is what we are first and foremost. We are citizens of, you know, our environmental communities, of our, like, as Americans, we are citizens of so many other things before we are just, you know, consumers. And that's such a narrow-minded way to address this issue. And we cannot consume ourselves out of this crisis. Like, there is no amount of, like, recycled polyester socks you can buy. There's no amount of fake meat you can buy that will fix this mess. And like, yes, you should be a more mindful consumer. But if you think that the only way we can fix this is to consume more of different things, then you are falling into the same ideological trap that got us here.
Totally. And I think you and I use this language such as like capitalism is the problem, kind of burn it all down speak, which I am all for. But I think for a lot of people, like that's kind of hard to digest and almost like a little overwhelming. What would you say to people like maybe for some more actionable steps that they can take to fight for systemic change that maybe doesn't sound as overwhelming? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Totally. And I think that that is such an important perspective because, you know, I think that we still can, like, I would love to burn it all down, but we're not going to tomorrow. And I think it is so important to not sacrifice meaningful change because it's not the perfect change that I would like to see. I think any step is better than no steps at all, especially when those giant steps don't feel very practical or possible in the moment. And I think that, you know, big things we can do is like there are ways in which that you, like, once again, mindful, being a mindful consumer is a huge thing you can do, and being responsible and engaging with the producers of the things you consume, like letting apparel and shoe companies know that you don't want to buy things that aren't made from post-consumer recycled products, letting races, I always write to races that I run and tell them that they should work with TerraCycle to recycle goo packages. Once again, I know that's like a very small drop in the bucket, but instead of just me making sure that I recycle my goo wrappers, if I can get the other 200 or so people racing with me to do that too, I think that's a much more meaningful thing. You can work with your local running stores. TerraCycle has a program that they'll work with local running stores to recycle running shoes and goo packets. And there are ways that you can still engage with the system we have to start pushing it towards a more mindful place. Anyone that works for a company should absolutely engage with their employer and make sure that they are not overly invested in fossil fuel extraction as a means of financial investment. You can push your employer to divest. You can push your university to divest from fossil fuel industries. And those are very meaningful actions you can take without burning it down.
Those are awesome suggestions. And in my mind, I kind of think of it as like little bubbles. Like we have our little bubbles and we want them to hopefully merge with other little bubbles to create bigger systemic change. And so how can we do that? How can we throw our little bubbles out into the universe in a bigger way? And that seems so much of what you're talking about, like bringing other people along.
Everyone has so many spheres of influence. And one of the biggest things we can do is just talk to people who are in our bubbles and are close to our bubbles, right? Like not in terms of an echo chamber, but like the people I run with, the people I work with, the people that I worship with, the people I play outside with, like all of those people that I bump into, you know, online or in real life, I can have really meaningful and listening oriented conversations with those people to encourage environmental action on a lot of different levels.
I love that. So you are a competitive trail runner. You write about trail runners. In the United States, competitive trail running is pretty white. And I know that you are also pretty passionate about environmental justice, but how do we get trail runners who are in, at least in the US, this pretty white space for the most part, to think about how environmental degradation affects them and the land they run on differently than it affects people of color?
Yeah, the fact, the really unfortunate fact about climate change is that that the less you contribute to it, the more likely you are to be impacted first and hardest by it. And I think that it's understandable that we're all approaching this issue from different places. Once again, coming from rural Arkansas, I did not always have as strong a perspective on environmental justice as I do now. And I feel like my really big push towards like my entree into environmentalism was through engaging with the outdoor world. Like I loved hiking, I loved trail running, I loved camping, I was a backpacking guide. So my initial engagement with environmentalism was very Zoe-centric and very like affluent white person centric. Like, how do I preserve spaces for me? How does this impact me? And as I've grown in my understanding of how climate change actually impacts other people significantly more than me, I've started to be able to address the unequal distribution of the burdens of climate change more as an environmentalist. And now I believe that there is no environmentalism without environmental justice, because the people who are impacted the most are, you know, typically communities of color and the most vulnerable people in societies. And we need to address the way that those people are impacted first and foremost before we're like worried about national parks or whatever. Like, I think, you know, setting aside preserving public land for, you know, can be a good thing. But for me, it's more about making sure that fossil fuels stay in the ground so that our air is cleaner, so that all citizens have access to cleaner air, all citizens have access to cleaner water. And it is so much more about people than it is about the planet for me now in some ways. Like the main reason that I am an environmentalist now is because of the people. And while I love the planet and the planet is great, the thing that I love most about it is that it is home to us. And I think that all environmentalism should be informed by a love of people first, because that's what it has to be about at the end of the day. Like if your environmentalism is purely about you or about setting aside things for like aesthetic enjoyment or like hiking or running, then it is going to fail the vast majority of people that it should be set up to benefit.
This brings us back so much to that idea of getting out of your lane and what you were discussing before about, like, I think trail runners, athletes in general, it's so much easier for them to think about like their trails, their track rather, and you know, how to protect that rather than the idea that climate change is going to impact communities of color, pollution is going to be most in communities of color, et cetera. So yeah, just such an important thread, I think, to keep in mind is that phrase of getting out of your lane that you brought up earlier.
Totally, because so long that we're all, as long as we're all compelled to like stay comfortable, stay where we are, not speak out politically, to stay in our lane, we are failing other people in other lanes who we may never meet. And that's a crime.
Do you see these conversations coming up to any large extent in the trail running community? Are people talking about the people-ness of climate change, how it affects people, not just the land? Like, where is the trail running community at with that?
Man, I think we have a long, long way to go. I think so much of the dialogue I see is about like how wildfires impact trails, or how floods or avalanches or like whatever, like here's how this affects you. And once again, I think it's just because like the industry does push us to take the like most relevant perspective. However, we're all people. This is our planet. We need to take a much wider lens. Like if, as long as we're compelled to take a narrow perspective on things like this, we're not going to get to the heart of the issue. And I just want to see a lot more conversation and a lot more people willing to get uncomfortable and engage in that climate justice space, engage in that more equitable environmentalism, an environmentalism that focuses on people rather than trails. Cause like, whatever, if trails disappear tomorrow, like sure I'd be bummed, but like, whatever, I'll get over it. We need to focus on people that are impacted by the problems that we're creating. Disproportionately, the action, like the way I live my life, disproportionately impacts people with a lot less means. And that is just wrong. And we need to radically recreate this industry and our culture generally to take into account those most vulnerable communities. And I don't know, the outdoor industry is focused on pretending that that's not our problem when it absolutely is. And I think that every conversation necessarily needs to point to that, because to me, any conversation around environmentalism that doesn't include justice or doesn't include equity and doesn't focus on the most vulnerable amongst us is going to fall flat.
Yeah, thank you for bringing up so many important ideas that I hope everyone listening takes to heart. And I want to discuss another issue that I know you're passionate about, which is rural issues, issues in rural communities. I started this conversation talking about how you're in Colorado, I'm in Brooklyn, New York. I think a lot of the outdoor recreation industry markets towards urban tourists, or at least people who are in less rural areas and have maybe some more disposable income, you know, maybe glossy, expensive gear and plane rides to XYZ location. And I'm wondering how the outdoor recreation industry can have a positive impact on the communities, which are often more rural, where a lot of this recreation takes place.
Yeah, I think one of the amazing things about outdoor recreation, one of the things that I really see the outdoor recreation, that I'm a huge optimist around the outdoor recreation economy, is how it is more able to sustainably and equity develop, or more equitably add to the economies of rural places. Like if you look at where I live in rural Colorado, the outdoor industry employs over 500,000 people and the extraction industry employs just under 30,000. And money that goes into the extraction industry typically tends to end up in the pockets of corporations, where as money spent in the outdoor recreation industry goes to restaurants, hotels, people taking tickets at national parks, like it tends to circulate in rural economies significantly longer than extraction money does. And so investing in industries that develop rural economies rather than just extract from them is a great way that you can engage with outdoor spaces, right? Like I think that that is one of the things to be very, very hopeful about, is like, the more we can invest in setting aside land for other people to enjoy and setting aside recreation infrastructure for other people to enjoy, because it leads to more sustainable and equitable economies. I think the problem becomes like some places almost become a victim of their own success. You'll start to see issues in terms of affordable housing in places like where I used to live in Aspen, where it becomes an almost unaffordable place for the majority of people to live. And it then becomes an environmental issue when you see people in the service industry being forced further and further from their place of work, forced to commute, while there is public transportation, forced to consume more fossil fuels just to go and basically work for another extraction industry. And that's a huge, huge problem, because it disproportionately affects people of color and more vulnerable communities. Once again, when you look at who tends to live the nearest the highway, who tends to be less close to public transportation hubs and who tends to need those resources the most. Then you see other things like in Leadville, which is one of my favorite places on planet Earth. It's a small town in the Rocky Mountains above 10,000 feet. Every time I visit Leadville, I make sure that I pack my own trash out with me because the people of that town have to pay to recycle anything that I just happen to throw away or recycle while I'm in town. And so making sure that when you go to smaller communities, that you're trying to engage in the economy in a way that's very mindful. Because while those places are supported overall by outdoor recreation and tourism, you still have to be very mindful about like what you're doing and how, you know, just like little things like what you're doing, throwing things away, buying things at the grocery store, like small towns that only have one grocery store, how large amounts of tourists can really disproportionately impact these vulnerable food systems. You have to be mindful of that. Like if you've ever been to the Leadville grocery store on a race weekend, it is a complete disaster. And there are people that live there. And I think just bearing in mind that whenever you're visiting one of these communities that you are a guest and that you should just do a little bit of extra research and do the legwork so that you can engage more compassionately and more mindfully when you're visiting places.
Zoe, I love that you talk about these issues because I don't think they're understood by a wide range of people.
Well, I mean, the economy like only functions when we don't understand them, right? Like as long as you're, you know, like, I don't think that people never need to vacation. Obviously, once again, these communities are supported by tourism in a way that is positive in some ways. Mm-hmm. And obviously if like tourists stop existing, then Colorado's economy would come crashing to the ground. But you just have to do it mindfully. And you have to do it in a way where you're trying to tread lightly, both environmentally and in terms of your economic impact on the community you're visiting.
Totally. So this is kind of a big question. I'm not sure that anyone has the complete answer, but how do we kind of like teeter that line of trying to support the economy in rural communities without, you bring up the example of Aspen, without turning it into an economy that only works for some people and pushes other people out?
Yeah, I think, you know, it really varies place to place. So like doing your research on the place you're visiting and seeing if there are ways that instead of supporting larger corporations, you can potentially make sure that your dollar circulates for longer in the local economy, going to locally owned, patronizing locally owned businesses, or maybe even bringing your own food. And like, I'm a huge fan of camping. Like I love camping. That's a great way to minimize, you know, some amount of like disproportionate housing inequity. And I think that it just totally depends on like understanding and trying to learn more about the specific place that you're visiting. You know, in some ways it's going to be waste management. In some ways it's going to be like when and where you spend your money. In some ways it could be what time of year you go. And, you know, I think like, you know, there's great ways like in Aspen, I'm a huge fan of, they're putting a lot of money into developing the uphill economy, which is a more sustainable snow economy that relies less on lift serve recreation and more on human powered recreation. I think that's a great way to minimize both your environmental impact, your economic impact, and to get a little fitness in while you're at it.
I love that. So cool. So many important thoughts keep coming up. So many important thoughts in this whole conversation.
It's a complicated issue. And I wish there was, you know, like a solution, but I think, you know, the closest thing I can offer to, any singular answer is to just like do a little bit of research and think deeply for yourself about like what your core values are and how you can live those out as a visitor on other people's stolen lands.
Which is honestly the only thing we can all do for any issue. Like no right. one, I don't think anyone has the answer for really anything.
Yeah. So let me know when we do have it.
Yeah. I'll let you know if I come up with something, but so I want to make sure to touch on your own athletic achievements, which you've had many, and you recently ran the fastest known time on Capitol Peak, which is in Colorado, this August. I understand that was like a pretty scary experience, or at least that traverse is pretty scary. What was it like in your words?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan. Like I really love scrambling and I love somewhat exposed terrain. So it was a really, but I'm also like a little bit of a fraidy cat. Like I'm not like 100% totally comfortable. No, you know, no fear at all in that. Like, I'm very afraid of falling. It's always like held me back in rock climbing and some amount in running. So I wanted to kind of embrace that fear as part of the challenge of setting the FKT on Capitol Peak. It's famously known as one of the more difficult Colorado 14ers. It's also the one closest to my house. And as I've said, I'm a huge fan of recreating close to home in a way that both minimizes your environmental impact and respects the local guidelines of different COVID issues, and not trying to, you know, get too far out of my own county. Yeah, I've always wanted to set an FKT on a Colorado 14er, and that one just happens to be my favorite and happens to be closest to home and kind of fits into my alpine skill set, which is that I'm decently fast on running and okay enough at scrambling to set that FKT.
Okay. I'll say that you're pretty damn fast, pretty great at scrambling from what I've read and seen on your social media. So you can be humble, but I'll allow myself to
I like speed scrambling is pretty fun to me.
Awesome. So what are your future goals, either athletically, career-wise, or in anything?
Career-wise, I think that like just pushing the trail running community and the outdoor industry in general, and trying to be a critic of what we're doing, a loving critic. Like, to me, criticism is how you engage deeply with the things you love the most. And for me, that thing is the outdoor industry and the outdoors and how we engage with the environment as outdoorists. And so always trying to be that, that voice that's saying like, you know, I want to engage very deeply on this issue. However, I don't think we're doing it perfectly. Do I always have the solutions? No, I don't. But I would love to start to see like where there's maybe tears in the fabric we can start to repair. Or if we need to rebuild things, like I would love to be someone that at least points to some of the first issues to address. And so I think, you know, using the platform I have through Trail Runner Magazine to try to bring up issues that are often overlooked, that are often talked about in the narrow ways we discussed earlier, and that sometimes just like aren't that fun, aren't that sexy to talk about. I would love to make space in the industry for like policy discussions about environmental justice, equity, economics, things that are, you know, don't always make you the most popular person at a cocktail party, but will necessarily build a better world. I think that's like the big picture of what I'd like to do, and just like keep bringing up climate within the outdoor space at every given opportunity, and try to use my platform to like normalize those discussions and bring more people into the fold. Because one of the things that I think is so amazing about Trail Runner is that I'm very much not preaching to the choir. It has a really diverse readership. It has a readership that is demographically different than me. We disagree on things, and that is very, very important to me. Like, every time if I write something on Instagram, it's going to be seen by like a few dozen people who totally agree with me anyway. And like, we all voted for Joe Biden, so it's fine. When I get to speak to the Trail Runner audience, I'm speaking to people who are not coming at these issues from the same angle and approach as me. And I feel like that makes them infinitely more impactful, is that I get to reach people who maybe haven't been pushed to consider these things. And I think that that's kind of what excites me the most about that opportunity. And then I just want to return to racing safely this year and or find some more FKTs that are close and exciting.
Well, I'm so excited for all of your goals, and I'm so excited for all of the issues you continue to bring up through your work, because like you said, yeah, maybe they're not the sexiest to talk about, you know, getting out of your lane and addressing these real issues, but they're sexy to me. I'm here for it. And I think to a lot of people they are, and they're so important. So I can't wait to see everything that you do in the future.
Thanks so much, Emma. You too. I'm such a fan of, you know, using sport as a platform to talk about things that are sometimes challenging to talk about, but are always so exciting and interesting to lean into. And I've always felt that sport just gives us that connection to talk about things that are not always comfortable, that we don't always have in common. And I think you guys do that so well at Social Sport.
Oh, thank you so much. And we're not done talking about you. I have a few rapid fire questions.
Awesome.
So first of all, if you could run anywhere in the world, where would you go?
I would love to, I went to high school in Italy for a while, and I would love to run in Cinque Terre, which is like a coastal group of five beautiful towns. That's like, it's like every time you see a screensaver of Italy, like that's where it is. And I would love to run there. I think it's like 30 miles to link them all up, which seemed, you know, impossible when I was in high school. Now I'm like, oh, I could probably do that and eat so like pizza beautiful in each town.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to go there after college, the summer after.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing.
I hiked around there, but yeah, so, so beautiful. What is your favorite pizza topping? I know you're a pizza enthusiast.
I really like shiitake mushrooms. I'm just like a huge fan of mushrooms. I think they're cool and they taste amazing. And shiitake is just like, there's just no flavor like it. It's a very umami pizza.
Amazing. That's creative and exciting. Sounds delicious. What is the cutest thing your dog has ever done?
She like makes little sounds like she's trying to talk occasionally. Like it sounds like muffled speaking, and it's so cute because I just feel like I know what she's saying. She'll just be like, and I'm like, I'll be right there, Bowie. Don't worry. It's really cute.
That's adorable.
She's very verbal, just like me.
So the last question that I ask everyone, why is sport a powerful platform for social change?
Oh, because it allows us to connect with people who have nothing in common with us besides running. As long as we're only talking to people that agree with us or look like us or think like us, we're falling far short of our potential as humans and communicators. And sport puts us in the room and on the planet with people who, once again, the only thing we have in common with is like, we love running trail. And it's the closest thing to a superpower as I can imagine, is being able to talk to people who are different than you.
I think everyone, not just trail runners, not just athletes, needs to hear that it is crucial to be able to talk to people who are different than you. I think the world needs a lot more of that in our consciousness.
Yeah. And sport just has such an amazing ability to bring people together and just throw different people together. And that's one of the things that, like, you know, as someone who, you know, came from an academic background, you know, sometimes people are like, well, why did you get into sports journalism? Like, you're so smart. Like, you could be, you know, you could still be writing. You could be writing for other places. And I'm like, but sport allows me to use these like academic gifts or like these intellectual gifts I have to talk to people who have that same kind of like intellectual hunger for like smart, intelligent things that challenge them. And I think that it's so cool that kind of niche within our community is growing.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I love that last statement. And I just love everything you do. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming
on. Thanks so much, Emma.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Social Sport. Zoe is one of those people who just leaves me feeling hopeful and invigorated and ready to save the world. And honestly, we could all use a little bit of that energy in our lives. I'm super lucky because I feel this way after speaking to so many of my guests, and that's my favorite thing about hosting Social Sport. If you also feel energized by these conversations, there are a few things you can do to keep the show running. You can leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also donate to Social Sport through Anchor. All you have to do is go to anchor.fm/socialsport and click support. Then you can pledge as little as $1 a month to support the show. If you have a small business and want to sponsor Social Sport, or maybe you just want to reach out and say hi, which I always love, you can send me an email at socialsportpod@gmail.com. You can also find me on Instagram at socialsportpod. Wow, that was a mouthful. If you're still with me, thank you. Thank you for coming along today. And as always, stay sporty and keep resisting.